This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the start of August, and this week it was political debates that dominated the political debate. 20 Democratic presidential candidates took the stage over two nights in Detroit. It was the same lineup as in June, but with Montana Governor Steve Bullock swapped in to replace California Congressman Eric Swalwell, not that you necessarily noticed. The first night had Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders fending off attacks from more moderate and less popular candidates. Less popular because most of the moderate support goes to Joe Biden, who was on the second night fighting off Kamala Harris and Cory Booker. Later in today's show, we will look at the winners and losers from these debates, who had the best arguments, and who positioned themselves best to be the nominee. Now, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center, and I'm joined by Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post on the right. On the left is Helene Olin of The Washington Post, and Lynette Lopez, senior finance reporter at Business Insider, is our special guest for this show. Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
So I actually want to start this week by talking about trade with China. It was a topic at the debates, and it was also an issue on which President Trump took somewhat surprise action on Thursday, announcing 10% tariffs on a further $300 billion a year of Chinese imports. That move caused sharp declines in stock prices, interest rates, and oil prices, all signs that the markets think the escalation of the trade war with China is going to be bad for the global economy. Megan, what did you make of this move?
Well, I think that for President Trump, trade wars are a bit like Axe body spray is for 14-year-old boys. If you do not get the desired attention or results from the first round of application, just keep spraying them on until finally you get what you want. I don't think that this works any better for Donald Trump than it does for 14-year-old boys. But I think that that really does sort of go to his fundamental idea about how politics works, about how economics and business work, which is, you know, he has like a couple of tricks in his bag, and he just keeps pounding those nails with the same two hammers over and over and over again. Occasionally he gets lucky and it works. More often it fails spectacularly. But since one of those tricks worked to get him to the Oval Office in 2016, he feels validated in this life strategy.
Helene, how much does the Federal Reserve give the president cover to impose these tariffs? Because before the president announced these tariffs on Thursday, we had a press conference on Wednesday from the Federal Reserve Chairman Jay Powell. The Fed announced that they were cutting short-term interest rates by a quarter point. And Powell also made these comments. Everyone wants to know, well, you know, are you going to cut interest rates more? And one of the things he said was basically that's going to depend on what the global trade situation looks like. And if there's more trouble, more uncertainty in global trade, that's something that could lead to more easing, more interest rate cuts. So it seems that the signal that Powell is sending there is the more trouble the president causes like this, the more interest rate cuts he's going to get, and that will do something to offset, one hopes, the economic damage that might come from the tariffs.
Right. I mean, I would use a slightly different analogy than Megan. I think of Trump as sort of a parent in a dysfunctional home who governs by unpredictable temper and chaos. And I think that everyone is responding to him because they know that as a result. We never know quite when he's going to go off. It results in people sort of kowtowing to him ultimately. They ultimately will do what he wants, even though they don't necessarily want to do it. And I think we kind of saw this with the Federal Reserve this week, where they kind of left room open to maneuver around him, which is exactly what you would do with a chaotic, dysfunctional person in charge of your life.
But the Fed is doing the right thing there, right? I mean, the Fed is supposed to respond to economic conditions. That includes economic conditions created through the president's dumb policy actions.
Right. But it's a no-win situation for the Fed, because, of course, if they don't respond to it, they're going to make things worse. But on the other hand, that they do respond to it simply encourages him. And I would say that's Trump's strategy. To me, that's always been Trump's strategy, is he kind of sets off chaos and then does whatever the heck he wants. And within that chaos, he kind of gets his way.
That erratic parent analogy, though, can also be that can be used on the Chinese response. If you read the readouts from both countries after the Steve Mnuchin, Robert Lighthizer jaunt to Shanghai, both of them were...
That's Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, and Robert Lighthizer, who's the U.S. Trade Representative, our top trade negotiator with China and other countries.
Yes, they were in Shanghai long enough to put their little heads on a soft, soft pillow and then come right home. And After that, you know, both countries put released readouts that seemed somewhat positive to give both governments political room to continue to make negotiations, especially the Chinese government, which has ginned up a lot of nationalist sentiment in the media. You know, you can only really, Xi can really only de-escalate if it seems like the United States is also going to de-escalate. So Trump ramping it up to 1,000 the way he did the very next day paints Xi into a corner as well, because his people are in a frenzy, the media is in a frenzy, and this does not give him the opportunity to go back to the table with the United States.
So Lynette, when Helene says, you know, the president throws tantrums and eventually he gets his way, it sounds like you're suggesting that that's not going to eventually get his way with the Chinese, essentially because it's too embarrassing for them to give in to him at this point. Do you not buy the president's theory, basically, that the tariffs cause a lot more economic damage to China than they cause to the United States? So even if there's pain here, there's more pain there, and they eventually have to cave?
China is prepared for economic pain. They're going to have economic pain, whether there's a trade war or not, because of their cycle in deleveraging. This is a perfect excuse for Xi and the People's Bank of China to lower rates, to maybe, you know, let the yuan depreciate a little bit and blame it on Donald Trump instead of their domestic situation.
Megan, does that sound right to you?
Look, I think that the fact is that what Donald Trump wants from China is for them to not export nearly as much stuff to us, and to buy a lot more of our stuff. And that's something I think China can't do. I'm not arguing about whether it's fair or not, but for internal political reasons, the idea the Chinese Communist Party can actually give in on this stuff and sort of try to compete as if they were a Western European nation, that would be politically disastrous for them. And so, you know, they're looking at the lesser of two evils. And for them, at least the trade war kind of mobilizes the population against America and stirs up exactly the same kind of nationalist sentiment, by the way, that Trump is using these trade wars to stir up. So there's a kind of vicious cycle here.
Not nearly as effective, but yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but I mean, right, is that it's better for them to have a trade war in which they can blame America than it is to make concessions in which people will be like, why are you such a wuss? You sold us out to the Americans.
Megan describes there what I think is President Trump's view on what the trade problem is with China, that he's just singularly focused on the trade deficit. His concern is that China exports too much stuff to us, doesn't buy enough stuff from us. Everyone on the Democratic stage seemed to agree that there is some sort of trade problem with China, although I don't think people buy the president's framing of it. But so what is the problem in trade with China? Since everyone seems to agree that there's a problem that needs to be fixed here, what do we need a policy that gets at? Because I think that's been very unclear from a lot of the candidates.
So I think there is actually there are a bunch of problems with China, right? I mean, so one is that their state-led industrial policy results in things like massive gluts and overcapacity in industries like steel. Right. And then everyone else has to deal with the fallout of the wild swings in the prices that they cause by dumping a huge amount of product on the market that probably wouldn't have been built if the kind of market were disciplining the construction of these steel companies rather than state-owned banks. So that's one problem. Another problem is, like, if you look at what we're good at doing, they do, in fact, attempt to shield domestic industries, protect domestic industries from the stuff where America has a competitive advantage while taking free trade terms from us on the stuff that they sell. And so, yes, it would be good to see China, for example, embrace more robust intellectual property controls. That's all stuff that should be on the table, but it's going to be a long time getting there, right? This is not like Donald Trump is going to have a trade war and then he's going to go sit down at the table and 2 months later he's going to come away with everything he wants. It's going to take years to push China into entering world trade on a kind of more level playing field now that they have reached middle income and are trying to work towards high-income country status. Eventually, they're going to have to get there.
There are a lot of businesses here in the United States that would love to be in China that are simply not allowed. There are a lot of partnerships that are forced between American companies and Chinese companies, where the exchange of ideas is not necessarily on the up and up.
And the IP theft in particular is a huge problem that is extremely real. And also things like Huawei maybe having backdoors so that they can spy on U.S. consumers. These are actually
real
problems
yeah.
that
right.
need to be addressed.
And we have to address also the fact that Xi Jinping running is a nastier sort of authoritarian government than his predecessors. You know, that he seems more like interested in closing the economy than opening it. And we have to adjust our relationship with the country to that new reality.
Yeah, and the president has not seemed focused on that. I mean, he even had comments this week essentially to the point that Hong Kong is part of China, and that's something that they're going to have to work out internally, which is not normally the talking point you'd expect from a U.S. president. I thought that the parts of the debate about international trade were actually some of the most productive parts of the debate this week, substantive and got at real distinctions between the candidates. One thing you heard from Maryland Congressman John Delaney, and also to an extent from former Vice President Joe Biden, was that a big mistake was getting out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that was an agreement that would have put us on a united front with Japan and Australia and Canada and eight other countries around the Pacific to basically try to set the terms of global trade policy with China on the other side of the table. And then you also heard Delaney essentially arguing that Elizabeth Warren was proposing to replicate some parts of the problems with the president's trade policy.
We can't isolate ourselves from the world. We can't isolate ourselves from Asia. Senator Warren's plan basically that she put out, we would not be able to trade with the United Kingdom. No, we would not be able to trade with the EU. It is so extreme that it'll isolate the American economy from the rest of the world.
Senator?
Senator Sanders,
please let Senator Warren respond.
Oh, I'm sorry.
What the congressman is describing as extreme is having deals that are negotiated by American workers for American workers. American workers want those jobs, and we can build the trade deals that do it. People want access to our markets all around the world. Then the answer is, let's make them raise their standards. Make them pay their workers more. Let their workers unionize, raise their environmental standards before they come to us and say they want to be able to sell their products.
So, Helene, isn't that basically Trump's view? People want access to our markets, and therefore we get to set terms. And the concern raised by Delaney and others there is that the terms she has set are so extensive that it's effectively going to make it impossible to enter new trade agreements and call into question the existing agreements we have and make it difficult for us to build that global coalition to take on China.
Well, I certainly don't think Trump is that concerned about environmental damage. But aside from that, I think there are links, and I think this is part of Warren's appeal, frankly, is that to typical, you know, workers and voters, these are real problems, and that these are the issues that they think about when they think about trade. And they do need to be addressed. Now, I also think it's also helpful to think of Warren's policy proposals as kind of ideal versions of the world. I mean, the chances of them, if she becomes president, being enacted as is, and I mean this for all of her proposals, are somewhere, you know, less than zero. But I do think it's important to get these statements out there of where you stand and what you believe.
Yeah, I mean, this is about what Americans value when it comes to doing trade with other countries. And I don't think that American workers feel like they were placed in the conversation or had any value in the last, you know, few decades of trade negotiations. What's wrong with that?
Well, but so isn't Helene's argument there then, Megan, isn't that premised on the idea that basically this is an opening negotiating position for Warren and that she will fight hard for these things and get some of them, but ultimately be able to reach deals? Because one thing we've seen with President Trump is trade is one of the areas of presidential power where the president doesn't have to compromise if they don't want to on a lot of things. You can.
That was exactly the point that I was going to make.
Yeah.
Look, I think Warren is making a run for Trump voters, and I think it's a pretty good run, right? I think that this is actually like her kind of saying, you know, Trump protectionism, but with, you know, 50% less racism and, you know, more environmental standards, right? That's actually potentially a very appealing pitch to at least some portion of Trump's electorate. But I think that there's a couple things there. Do I think she's necessarily sincere about this? I kind of doubt it. She's a Harvard law professor, just kind of looking at who she is. I really doubt that Elizabeth Warren is like an avid trade warrior. She's probably fairly in her deepest heart of hearts fairly pro-free trade. And so I think the real risk is that, and this, we'll talk later about this, but in some of the ways that, you know, campaigning on a very hardline version of Medicare for All, or impeachment, or any of these other things, is that, you know, you say that to kind of try to attract the base, but then you get elected, and if that's what you told people you were going to do, they expect you to try to do it. And the thing is that Warren can actually do a lot of the stuff that she's talking about fairly unilaterally in the same way that Trump has. And so, you know, I think there's always the question of, are you creating a Frankenstein's monster that is eventually going to get loose of its creator and sort of start ripping things up, in this case, our trade agreements. And I think there is a real risk with this kind of campaigning.
Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and talk about much more that was discussed at this week's debates. I will be back with Megan McArdle and Helene Olin of The Washington Post and Lynette Lopez of Business Insider. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Megan McArdle of The Washington Post. On the left is Helene Olin, also a columnist of The Washington Post. And Lynette Lopez of Business Insider is our special guest. So we talked about trade, but obviously there was much, much, much more than trade. Helene, who won these debates?
I don't think anybody won these debates, actually. I think everybody... I went through and read tons of commentary at one point and came to the absolute conclusion that everybody thought the candidate that they liked the most won the debate. I read impassioned defense, you know, impassioned Biden won the debate, Warren won the debate, Sanders won the debate. I even saw John Delaney won the debate. I saw Inslee. I mean, it was across the board. And conversely, people generally thought whoever they didn't like didn't do particularly well. So you saw, well, you know, Warren and Sanders only did well because they teamed up and, you know, they were against some Lilliputians. And you saw, well, Biden only did well because, you know, he was against Harris and so on. And Harris only did well. Or, you know, not because she wasn't fully attacked the way she deserved and so on down the line. And I think it just sort of became a sort of wash. And I think that was the public's reaction, too. I mean, barely anybody watched. I think it had a viewership of about 8 million, if that. And to be honest, it's actually already, it's Friday, it's already kind of hard to remember very much of it.
So I mostly agree with that, with two exceptions. One is that I don't really think I saw anybody saying that they thought Kamala Harris had a good night. Even people who were fans of Kamala Harris, if you didn't work for her campaign, you probably weren't saying that she won the debate. And then the flip side of that is I saw a lot of people saying that they really thought Cory Booker did a good job and had sort of elevated himself above the lower tier position that he had managed to hold on to in this debate. Megan, I know you wrote about Kamala Harris this week.
Yes, I think that there's no question that she lost the debate, in part because, you know, her last debate, she was definitely the clear winner. She went into that debate polling at 7%. She comes out polling at 15, right? That is a major move. And that is because she took the fight to Joe Biden, sort of questioning him about his history opposing federal school busing efforts. And people thought, oh, here is the fighter who can really dismantle Trump on stage. But the problem with that is that she then went into this debate as a front runner and people were gunning for her. And it turns out that she's all offense and no defense. And so when people started landing punches, she was just reeling and really not able to mount an effective response. On the other side of that, I thought Elizabeth Warren did well enough. I mean, I think she slightly improved her position. She looked very good, but mostly she's siphoning voters from Bernie, who I think did not do well in this debate. Not because he did badly, but merely because he's just holding steady. He's not really widening his support. Cory Booker, I agree, absolutely, like, got himself noticed, finally, after months and months of waiting for this to happen. I think Andrew Yang, also, I don't think he's going to be president, but I think that, you know, he went into this debate with almost no one knowing who he is. He made a couple of very well-timed jokes, sounded very coherent and, you know, plausible, if not to me personally, very convincing on things like his signature universal basic income initiative. And so I think there were a number of people who really came out of this debate looking much better. But in part, that was because one of the sort of great white hopes came out looking much worse.
Can we, and I hope this is the last time in my life I ever have to say this phrase, can we talk about Andrew Yang for a moment?
Hallelujah.
you mean the TED Talk version of politics?
Yeah, I don't get it at all. I don't get the people who are, you know, talking about, oh, you know, good night for Andrew Yang. I mean, I guess, you know, if you're judging it like a high school debate competition and, you know, he won some points, that might be right. But the problem with Andrew Yang is that his central idea that virtually every problem in society is best addressed through a universal basic income of $1,000 a month is both wrong on the merits, and also it doesn't speak to any particular constituency in the Democratic Party. I mean, he has this idea that basically the problem is that our jobs are being automated away, which if it's ever going to happen, it's not happening yet. If that was what was happening, you would see really fast productivity growth in the economic data because the robots would be doing all the things that people used to do, and yet productivity growth is actually pretty slow. And then, you know, what kind of Democrat is supposed to be into the Andrew Yang message? If you just want things to go back to normal and you want a third Obama term, he's not your guy. If you're very concerned about inequality and the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few powerful people who have political and economic power, he's not your guy. If you're very concerned about racial justice, he's not your guy. He said this sort of bizarre thing about how basically it's too late on climate change and we need to give people money so they can afford to move to higher ground. I do not get at all what the supposed Yang constituency is supposed to be.
I've actually gone to I went to an Andrew Yang rally, so I can actually talk about this, okay? So you go to a rally, right? And it's a bunch of guys, I'd say 35 and under, many of whom like have to pause for a minute before they answer a question like, who did you vote for in 2016? They often can't remember if they voted in the primary. If you ask them who they voted for in the general, there's also this pause, and then they all say Hillary Clinton. And I'm not convinced if that means they had to think about it, whether they are voted for Trump and know they shouldn't say that, or if they actually didn't vote. I mean, I'm not convinced of any of those. But what I think it does is it appeals to this kind of people who, I don't want to say they're disenfranchised because they're tech guys. By definition, they're not disenfranchised, but they see themselves as disenfranchised. And, you know, this is this kind of, you know, vaguely like...
We could do an entire episode on these guys.
Right, exactly.
They've taken over the internet.
This is right. not
and
a large
exactly,
voting block.
It's an intern... Right, no, it's not no. at all. And it might not even be a voting block because, again, as I said, I'm not sure how many of them vote. But, you know, this is the sort of stuff that looks really great on an internet chat board. I mean, this is
Bingo.
Like right, exactly. It's a platform for an internet chat board.
It is a platform that appeals to people like engineers who like systems with very simple rules, right? That's actually like a lot of libertarians in that camp, right? Is they like extremely simple operating rules and then it's kind of set it and forget it government. And I think it does appeal to those people. And I should point out that while it is true that probably most of the people coming out for him didn't vote in 2016, certainly in a primary. Trump did pretty well in 2016 by mobilizing those people because, in fact, even though they're not a big portion of the electorate, the primary voters are not a big portion of the electorate. And so if you can get people moving, you can get a fairly small group to swamp primaries, especially in early races. That said, I do not think Andrew Yang is going to be president. And what I want to ask is, like, is that the point? Right. So, yes, if you're asking, like, why would he be doing this if it's not this kind of classic Democratic, like a little bit from column A, a little bit from column B, a little bit from column C coalition building politics that is how Democratic primaries usually work, then yes, it's not a good strategy. But is the goal to actually become president, or is the goal to get himself noticed, to make himself higher profile, to get his ideas on the board? And I think he did that in that debate.
Lynette, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about anybody other than Andrew Yang and Marianne Williamson. You haven't gotten in yet on the who won question. What were your big takeaways on winners and losers?
My big takeaway is that the progressives won and the moderates just sounded blah. They just sounded like they didn't have any answers, and they sounded like they were not willing to make the sweeping changes that I think a lot of Americans want to see. I think that the progressives were right. A lot of people are not happy with their health insurance, as much as I hate to say Bill de Blasio was right. And I think that, you know, when you hear guys like John Delaney and Tim Ryan talk about confronting China on green tech or in the technological space at all, they say things like, oh, well, I'm going to hire a chief manufacturing officer. It's like, that's not a real plan, Mr. Ryan. That's actually nothing. You need to put your money where your mouth is. China has spent billions and billions of dollars and has spent a lot of time planning their technological advancement. The United States needs to at least match that effort to be able to go toe-to-toe with them. See what you want about the AOC New Green Deal. At least it matches the problem in scale, even if you don't agree with the actual mechanics of her plan. The moderates just sounded like they were pithy, like they didn't have any real solutions, and that they were not up to the task of winning the next century or the next generation or whatever the next monumental thing is.
So here's what I don't get about this. If the Democratic primary electorate is hungry for a bold progressive who wants to, you know, really radically reimagine what government is for, wants things like single-payer health care, that sort of thing, why does Joe Biden have such a persistent poll lead? I thought it was weird how much of the analysis of this debate and of the campaign generally has sort of glossed over the existence of Joe Biden. There was an op-ed by Brett Stevens in the New York Times this week complaining that, quote, Democrats are not up to their historic responsibility, unquote. He's this, you know, conservative columnist who wants the Democrats to not be such a liberal party because he doesn't care for Donald Trump. And he's complaining, you know, you had John Delaney and Tim Ryan up there making these good points, but nobody's voting for them. But people are intending to vote for Joe Biden. And you had Joe Biden up there forcefully pushing an incrementalist message and pushing back on some of the ideas from the progressive candidates, saying basically that if you take away employer-provided health insurance, the polls show that's unpopular. You're going to get beaten up over that. There are a lot of people who want to ensure that everyone has health insurance, but who don't want to do that, saying that a lot of these plans that involve big tax increases, you'd have to tax the middle class for them, and that's impractical. And that incrementalist message basically saying, you know, we can't have maximum change. Here's what we did in the Obama administration. Let's build on that. That does seem to have a lot of appeal among voters in the Democratic primary.
I'd point out that a lot of Biden's appeal at this point seems to be that people think he can beat Trump.
And name recognition in general. We're early, yo.
Yeah, we're not that early. I mean, and Bernie Sanders has very, very high name recognition and is the champion of this message. And Sanders is nowhere in the polls.
I kind of think of these debates completely as prelude to September, when we will finally get all of the major competitors on one stage. And I think at that point, you might finally see some movement among the competitors that is actual real movement and will hold, as opposed to, for instance, after the first debate, where Biden fell after a fairly weak performance and then slowly crept back up as people kind of forgot about it.
So, Megan, one of the things that we heard when we were having these conversations between the center candidates and the left candidates is you would talk about one of these ideas like getting rid of employer-provided health insurance, and someone would say that's unpopular, and then the progressive candidate would say that's a Republican talking point.
This is not a Republican talking point.
This has nothing to do with Republican talking points.
Your question is a Republican talking point.
We cannot keep with the Republican talking points on this. You gotta stop.
The thing is, and a thing that I take from Joe Biden's poll lead is that a lot of voters do find this idea compelling, that if you have something, you know, you can say now it's a Republican talking point. In November, that talking point will be thrown at you. And if a lot of voters agree with it, that can be a thing that costs you the election to Donald Trump, and that it is important not just to shoot for the moon, but to have an agenda that's popular and wins elections.
Yeah, I think there's a real problem of epistemic closure on the left. And this had been a problem with the right, with, you know, the kind of closed media ecosystem for years. And now you're seeing it on the left. People are sorted into their little districts where they don't meet any Trump voters. I mean, literally, socially, I doubt anyone on this panel spends a lot of time with Trump voters. Right. And that actually matters. They don't spend a lot of time with the white working class or the minority working class. We don't spend a lot of time with the working class. And that gives you a very distorted view of what people's priorities are and what they want. Right. The kind of white progressive districts that are driving these guys and drive Twitter. You know, Kevin Drum had at Mother Jones had a great post yesterday pointing out, like, Twitter is melting these candidates' minds, is that they're actually, like, they think that represents, it doesn't even represent the activist base, right? It's the loudest and most kind of intolerant and eager to, like, call out and destroy people part of the activist base. And they're trying to move to the left of Bernie Sanders to get on the good side of that activist base, but it's actually a really small share even of the Democratic electorate. It's maybe 25% of the Democratic electorate, right? The rest of the electorate is not that hardcore. They don't want to spend all of their time hearing about, you know, like universal basic income, but also about, you know, reparations for slavery, et cetera. These things poll now better among white progressives than they do among minority voters. That's crazy, right? And so I think this is a real problem. But that said, let me also point out, you know, on from the case for the prosecution, is that while Joe Biden has like a third of the votes, right, he's kind of the only serious person in the moderate lane right now. Kamala Harris has been trying to straddle between the moderate lane and the progressive lane, I think not very successfully. And her Medicare for All plan, which is kind of a kludge, represents that, where she's not actually appealing to either set of voters. But because he has that lane to himself, right, he's going to have higher numbers than Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren splitting the same vote, even if that section of the vote is larger. I don't think we really know, but I do think that when you look at polls, you certainly see that on a bunch of immigration issues, on healthcare, and on other things, basically all of the front runners except Joe Biden are now to the left of the Democratic primary voter on those issues. And I think that is going to be very interesting as this campaign goes on.
Helena, I'd like your response to that. I'm especially interested in what you think about that health care plan from Kamala Harris, because she faced a lot of criticism over that in the debate. And it's also part of a sort of a broader narrative criticism around Kamala Harris, which is basically that she keeps changing her positions on things. She attacked Joe Biden over his past positions on busing in the last debate and then made comments after the debate that seemed to take the same position as him. She also does not want federally mandated busing integration of schools. And so is she properly getting attacked for basically trying to do that straddle in a transparent way and not having a clear core as to whether she's a moderate or a progressive?
I think the issue is with Medicare for All, it's a really complicated issue, right? We know that the term itself polls very well. And the reason the term itself appears to poll very well is because the term itself has sort of passed into the vernacular. And people sort of read into Medicare for All what they think what they want from Medicare for All. So, for instance, it seems that what is popular is the idea of opening up Medicare to people who want in. The thing that is popular is letting them buy in. Raising taxes is never popular, right? It's never going to be popular. But it's a simplistic argument, right? Because people don't quite realize how much they're paying in premiums. People are paying, if you count between what they're paying and what their workplace is paying, is, you know, well over $20,000. And somebody probably needs to make that argument in a way that is easy to comprehend and understandable in about two sentences from a typical voter, because that's about all most people are going to pay attention to it. So you get these more complicated plans, and I would put Kamala Harris's plan in the sort of more complicated plan. The minute you have to explain it for more than two sentences, you've already got a major problem on your hands. And that sort of is one of the issues with it. She, on stage, was actually sort of struggling to explain what it was, because it actually doesn't lend itself to a simplistic take. Medicare for All in the Sanders version is actually extremely easy to explain on a stage. We're going to, you know, move everybody into, you know, an expanded Medicare in 4 years, period, the end. You know, I would say a second issue that has crept in is the fact that Biden is going around blasting Medicare for All. Again, this term that has kind of passed into the vernacular that could really, you know, mean everything from simply opening up the Medicare system in the way, say, Beto O'Rourke would like to do, to what Sanders is doing. And the idea that this isn't going to come back to haunt the Democrats in next year is fantasy. It is going to come back to haunt the Democrats, and it is probably the most irresponsible thing Biden is doing.
See, I think that this is actually very reminiscent to the way that the Republicans talked about Obamacare. And I think what you're describing there, Helene, that, you know, Medicare for All is what people want to feel like it is actually very dangerous for the party, which is you're setting up a lot of different expectations in different people, and you cannot please sees all of them. Once you actually have to try to make a policy, the policy is not going to be what some of them expected. It's like saying, you know, we're going to repeal and replace Obamacare and replace it with something better, and that sounds good to everyone. And then you try to actually describe what you're going to do, and people describe to their shock whatever it is. In the Republican case, it's that, you know, a lot of people are going to lose, you're going to lose insurance altogether. There aren't going to be protections for pre-existing conditions. In the Democratic case, either it's that you're going to have enormous tax increases, and a lot of people who like their plans, including members of unions that negotiated hard for the plans that they have, and Biden brings this up, and I think a lot of people on the left of the party sort of wish this away as a problem. If you have especially good health care plans in the hands of union members, they don't necessarily want a fully level playing field where everyone has exactly the same type of plan. You may have to disappoint those people. And then Bernie, the simplicity that you're describing there comes from the fact that he's proposed a plan that is more generous than the actually existing health care system in any other country, where you're going to have coverage of everything. It's not going to be like in Canada, where you need a separate plan for prescription drugs, and then it's going to be coverage without cost sharing, without co-payments, without deductibles, without co-insurance, and that would be enormously expensive. Bernie has proposed a large middle-class tax increase, but it's still actually not enough to pay for what he's proposed. He's proposing to pay at Medicare rates, which would be enormous reductions in the payments to hospitals, which is likely to be both politically impossible and in certain cases economically impossible. And so you'd have to have compromises made in that process that would really upset a lot of people. And I think that's a problem with not being upfront about what it is. And then there's an additional problem, which maybe actually negates the other problem, which is that this is all theoretical. If a Democrat becomes president, you're going to have either a Republican-held Senate, or you'll have a Senate with a narrow Democratic majority, where whatever you want to pass through would have to go through the budget reconciliation process and would need approval from Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and John Tester. It's going to be hard enough to do something like the Biden plan, where you try to create a public option that competes with the private insurers. That will face a lot of resistance. There's no way they're going to be able to do any of these proposals. So I think, like the Republicans, a lot of the Democrats, especially the progressives, but even the moderates, are setting people up by promising them something that there's no way they're going to be able to deliver.
Oh, you sound like John Delaney. Ugh.
But John Delaney
so
is right.
He
is right.
And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Lynette Lopez, what's your Tweet of the Week?
My Tweet of the Week is from Hu Xijin. He's the editor of the Global Times, which is a very nationalist Chinese Communist Party tabloid. And a lot of people on Wall Street and in the business world have been watching this man's Twitter feed to try to understand how the Chinese side feels in the trade war. And this week, that really was a little bit unfortunate for them, because on Wednesday he tweeted, "Based on what I know, Chinese and U.S. negotiators had an efficient and constructive deep exchange on Wednesday. The two sides discussed increasing purchases of U.S. farm products and the U.S. side agreed to create favorable conditions for it. They will hold future talks." Obviously, this was not the case. And for everyone out there, very, very, very be careful trading, because this man is exactly what he says he is. He's a Communist Party mouthpiece. He's going to do exactly what the government says for him to do. He's going to say what is convenient and expedient for them. So please do not consider this a reliable Twitter feed for getting news about the trade war. Do your own work.
Megan McArdle, what's your Tweet of the Week?
It is from Representative Will Hurd of Texas 23. "I have made the decision not to seek re-election for the 23rd Congressional District of Texas in order to pursue opportunities outside the halls of Congress to solve problems at the nexus between technology and national security. This is a big deal for a couple of reasons. One, he is the only Black Republican in the House of Representatives, but also because he is representing Texas's lone swing district that stretches along the border from El Paso all the way to San Antonio. And he has evidently decided that he doesn't think he has very good chances of keeping it with Trump in office, which is a bellwether for how the 2020 election might go."
Helene Olin, what tweet struck you?
Came from journalist Leah Fessler, and I have to say I'm going to have to delete an expletive in the middle of it. And it goes, "I'm really sick of hearing that Dem candidates, especially Elizabeth, come across as, quote, too angry. If you're not, word deleted, angry at the state of American politics, you shouldn't be running for president." To which I can only add, damn right.
My Tweet of the Week comes from Hunter Walker, who's White House correspondent at Yahoo News. He tweets, "There was a pretty funny scene outside the spin room before the debate last night when a security guard asked CNN boss Jeff Zucker to show his credential. Zucker was clearly not pleased, but he complied." I've been talking with Helene Olin of The Washington Post and Megan McArdle of The Washington Post and Lynette Lopez of Business Insider. We will be back to talk more about the presidential debates. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. On the left is Helene Olin, also a columnist at The Washington Post. And Lynette Lopez of Business Insider is our special guest. A good chunk of the debates was also devoted to immigration. You had these arguments over whether illegal entry to the country should be a crime or just a civil violation. That's one Trump will surely be eager to litigate in November. But what I was more interested in was a dispute over what immigration is for. Joe Biden said, among other things, that foreigners who earn PhDs in the United States should be allowed to stay. And Cory Booker attacked him for that, saying that he was playing into the president's hands by pitting some immigrants against each other. Booker said, quote, "I heard the vice president say, if you got a PhD, you can come right into this country. Well, that's playing into what the Republicans want to pit some immigrants against other immigrants," unquote. Lynette, what strikes me about this complaint and a lot of the tenor of the conversation around immigration was that it seemed to reject the idea of immigration policy, which if you're going to have an immigration policy, it's about deciding which people who would like to immigrate to the country may do so and which may not, and that necessarily involves some amount of choosing across certain metrics about who gets to immigrate.
Sure. I just don't think any of this conversation was very clear or very, there were not a lot of good immigration plans that were put forth. There was more mudslinging about who gets to go where, what asylum is, what's civil, what's criminal. We haven't really even gotten past that discussion to decide who makes the next generation of Americans. And yeah, you do have to choose that in a sense, but I don't think the Democrats even have a sense of what their value is there. They're more just kind of putting out a fire that Donald Trump lit at the border and reacting to that. There's not a lot of proactive immigration discussion right now in the party.
Well, I think this goes back to a kind of longstanding schizophrenia in the Democratic Party, which has been resolved with one side winning. And what I mean by that is if you watch the DNC in the Democratic National Convention in 2016, before 6 o'clock, there were a lot of undocumented immigrant families and sympathetic cases getting up to talk, like a lot. This was a very heavy theme in the daytime proceedings. But as soon as the cameras came on and people were watching, then suddenly, I mean, there were cameras before, but as soon as it hit prime time, suddenly the undocumented vanished. And that's because what the Democratic Party was trying to do was to cater to a very active, vocal, influential portion of their base, which basically wants open borders, but also knows that, like, that's a deadly position to take in a general election and is not actually all that popular with the other portions of their coalition. Because Trump has been so horrible about immigrants, and so horrible generally, and because he's associated with an anti-immigrant position, the Democrats have reacted by kind of really moving quite close to that open borders constituency. They're not saying the words, but literally you can't, with the exception of a couple of the moderates, you can't get any of them to name anything that they would do to enforce the borders, right? And so you can say, well, that's not really open borders, and, you know, fine, let's have a semantic debate. The voters know. The voters know that what Democrats are unwilling to do is to commit to anything that would remove anyone from the country who is not a felon. And if you don't enforce your borders, then functionally you kind of have open borders. Now, look, I'm a libertarian. I like high immigration. This is not like a referendum on my personal views. I'm just saying this is where the Democrats are. They don't want to have that conversation about enforcing the borders at all, because there is this portion of their base that they're terrified of, and because the resistance has now moved closer to that portion of the base in reaction to Trump.
Helene, this actually feels in certain ways similar to the healthcare conversation, in that, you know, the because Trump's position is so egregious and so extreme, Democrats can all agree on not that, and they can have a majority of the electorate with them on the not that proposition. It's more that when they govern, they're actually going to have to make some of these decisions themselves. There really is an external crisis related to Central American migration that wasn't manufactured by Donald Trump, and whatever they do in response to that is going to upset a significant constituency that was on board for the not what Trump's doing position.
Right. I mean, Trump has kind of driven the Democrats crazy on this issue, in my view. I mean, I agree with Megan on a lot of this, actually. I mean, the issue is you can't have open borders. I mean, there's no question, as a nation, you cannot have open borders. But nobody really wants to say that at this point. I mean, the thing that is most popular within the party is actually the part that is not getting very discussed very much anymore, and that's protecting the Dreamers, which is a huge issue and is really destroying people's lives at this point, of people who really do not know if they're going to be allowed to remain in this country. And it's something that is just morally reprehensible that it is going on. And to me, that actually should be the first focus of dealing with this. And it should be stressed constantly. And I do agree that I think the Democrats are very afraid of where the base is on this. You've seen the real progressive wing of the party move an extremely left position on this, that is where almost, you know, the vast majority of the population, including, you know, plenty of people who in the Latino community, are not in support of either.
Lynette,
again, this is the same point that I was making before. There is no plan because Donald Trump has sucked up all the oxygen in the room and made this a topic about incredibly emotional images and a terrible feeling that we all feel when we think about the border. It is not something that we can discuss rationally anymore. It is hardly something that anyone says, I have this plan for, and it does X, Y, and Z. It is just, it's guttural now.
I think that that's true, but we should also point out that the Democratic Party has been moving in this direction for like 15 years. It's not something that just happened because of Trump. And in fact, Republicans would argue that in part this happened because Democrats kept refusing to enforce the border, other than kind of with Obama arbitrarily redefining how they defined deportations to make it look like they were deporting a lot more people, which they weren't. And so like that the reason Trump exists is that Democrats kept moving away from border enforcement, and then Republicans were happy to go along with them.
Although I would note that the public has also moved a lot over that period. When you look at polling from like Gallup and Pew on immigration levels, the public is much more inclined to say there should be more immigration. As many people say, they want more immigrants, as say they want less immigrants. If you look at the 90s, there was a strong consensus that people wanted less immigration. I think that's why the Democratic Party was
I think Democrats moved a lot faster than the public did. And in part, some of that is a reaction is partisan Democrats reacting to where their party went.
I want to talk about one more way in which President Trump loomed over this debate, which is in comments that he made at the beginning of the week attacking Maryland Congressman Elijah Cummings, who chairs the House Oversight Committee, which is one of the committees that investigates President Trump. Trump didn't like Cummings' comments about brutal detention conditions at the southern border. So Trump tweeted that the border is not as bad as Cummings' Baltimore-based district, which is, quote, a disgusting rat and rodent infested mess. If he spent more time in Baltimore, maybe he could clean up this very dangerous and filthy place, unquote. I was actually surprised going back through the transcripts how little this was discussed. Cory Booker did talk about it in his opening statement, and a lot of candidates talked more broadly about the need to stand up to the president's racism. But I think the candidates face a dilemma, basically, about how much to let the president drive the agenda with comments like this. You saw Cummings himself. His response was to attack the president for saying that he would get on board with Cummings' legislation on prescription drug pricing and then going back on that promise and saying, Mr. President, you know, where are you on prescription drugs? Basically turning it back to a healthcare part of the agenda when the president made these comments.
First of all, I don't know if the president was really reacting to those comments that Elijah Cummings made. I think he also might be reacting to the subpoenas that are flying around and the investigation that is going on into Jared Kushner and one of Trump's billionaire friends trying to sell nuclear secrets to the Saudis. I think that might have been a trigger for Donald Trump, as we know his family usually is. Obviously, the racism of Donald Trump is a knee-jerk reaction, and it's something that we have to consider as a country. You're going to have progressives and moderates trying to take this on differently. The progressives are going to say racism is a stain on this country. It's something that we need to, you know, bathe ourselves in fire, Marianne Williamson reparations. And then you're going to have the moderates who say, like, you know, only some of us are racist. It's something that Trump is ginning up that is not really at the surface or even near the surface. This is deep down and we can push it back down again. And I think that's the conversation that that Democrats need to have with one another. And also, you know, they need to start discussing the things that Trump is doing that are corrupt, that lead to these kind of outbursts, the issues that he's having with oversight that are creating this knee-jerk reaction that especially leads to racist comments when the people who are overseeing the oversight are Black.
I think there are sort of two separate questions about what Trump thinks he's up to here. One is, you know, is Trump doing this as a strategy because he thinks that it fires up his base and helps him win? The second question is Trump right about that? I think this is a gut level reaction for him. I also think he thinks this is something that helps him win. But there are a lot of things that Trump thinks about what helps him win that don't actually help him win. I mean, he ran playbooks that were bent on, you know, scaring people about outsiders and that sort of thing in the 2018 campaign. We saw it with Republicans in 2017 in Virginia, and it doesn't seem to have worked. So even if, you know, I think there's a tendency in the way people in the media talk about this to talk about it as though it is some you know, diabolical, brilliant strategy on the president's part. You can buy the idea that he's doing it for a strategic purpose without buying the idea that it is an effective strategy.
He has a certain low cunning, I grant him that. But I think that Trump cannot stand having the attention taking off of him, right? And he also cannot stand criticism. He's the most thin-skinned person I've ever seen operating in the public realm.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Helene Olin, what's your rant?
There was a mass shooting at the Gilroy Garlic Festival in Northern California this past weekend. Three people were killed, including two children. Adding to the horror, we've already stopped discussing it. We've come to take these ghastly events for granted, the same way we tolerate a host of other less than civilized behavior in our country. We need to demand better and not stop until we get it.
Megan McArdle, what's your rant?
Democrats seem to be working their way up to impeachment. And while I join them in wishing to see Trump exit the Oval Office as expeditiously as possible, I don't think that this is the most effective way to go about it, especially given that there's an election in basically a year. And yet, I don't even think the leadership wants it to happen. But what I worry is that what they're trying to do is just talk about it and not do it. But as the Republicans discovered in 1998, talking a lot about impeachment eventually leads the activist base to assume you'll do it and then forces you to actually go ahead.
Lynette Lopez, what's on your mind?
My rant is about the Jared Kushner attempt to sell nuclear secrets to the Saudis, along with Tom Barrack. Everyone around the president's social circle is slimy, is corrupt, has a long history of self-dealing, double-dealing. It's time for us to get a little bit more active and a little bit more interested in who all these people are. And, you know, say what you want about Michael Wolff, but in the beginning of his book, Fire and Fury, it seemed like Jeff Epstein and the same guy, Tom Barrack, who tried to sell nuclear secrets to the Saudis with Jared, they were hanging around the campaign. And we need to start really looking into who these people are, their histories, especially on Wall Street. I think that, you know, our commerce secretary could use a real once-over by a bunch of investigative journalists and some attention paid to his past and his current investments.
For my rant, for years, Republicans complained that companies were holding cash on the sidelines overseas because they'd have to pay taxes if they brought it back to America. Give the companies a tax break, Republicans said, and they'll invest here and we'll all grow. It didn't work, in part because the cash overseas wasn't cash and it wasn't overseas. When companies like Apple held profits abroad, they would hold them as corporate bonds. That is, Apple was lending the money to other companies, often American companies, who could invest the money where they liked. Now, Democrats have a similarly bad idea for one weird trick to grow corporate investment. They say, stop companies from buying back their shares. If companies can't buy their own shares, they'll have to do something else with it, like build factories and create jobs. But they won't have to do that. They can do what Apple did. They can hold it in bonds, do basically the same things with the cash their shareholders would have done if they'd given the cash back to the shareholders. You can't grow investment through accounting tricks like this that change where companies have to hold assets on their balance sheets. You have to actually make it more profitable to invest and grow, which is hard and which is why neither party has a really good prescription for it. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Megan McArdle, Helene Olin, and Lynette Lopez. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.